Thanks for coming on tonight, and welcome to Dr. Helen Pringle. She's a senior lecturer in social sciences and international studies at the University of New South Wales and the arts faculty, and also presiding member of the arts faculty. She's published many articles on political theory, human rights, and co-authored the book Australian Protocol and Procedures. But Helen wrote to me a couple of months ago saying that it was the 150th anniversary of the publication of On Liberty, and said what she was doing and her colleagues were doing about this, and I thought it would be a good occasion for her to come along and talk to the Sydney Institute. So special welcome to Dr. Pringle talking on John Stuart Mill for today. Many thanks.
Thank you. This year, as Jared said, is the 150th anniversary of On Liberty, and I want to talk about what John Stuart Mill is for us today, about what it means for us to be heirs to this great work. But to keep it current, I'm going to start with the rugby league story. Several years ago, Alan Jones was fined $10,000 for criticising the referee. Jones had characterised the refereeing as Al Capone stuff, and he demanded that the league examine the match if the credibility of the game is to survive. Times have changed. After quite a bit of genteel back and forth between Jones and the referee, Jones summed up his view, and I'll just move the here in these terms. He said, as John Stuart Mills argued, if you hack and hack away at the tree of opportunity, you won't fall into a cesspool of barbed wire. You won't fall into a bed of roses, but a cesspool of barbed wire. Jones assured the Herald that this was not his own work. And he told the reporter that, in fact, this was a quote from John Stuart Mill, and said you should have been familiar with it. The reporter, in turn, assured his readers that no such reference can be found in the works of Mill, and indeed Mill could not have said this, given that he died in 1873, and that was the year that barbed wire was invented. Jones would have saved himself a lot of trouble if he'd read his own work, as 2 years before this match he'd cited the passage more or less accurately, and correctly attributed it to a writer who should have known better. I'll leave you to guess who that was, and I have a book that I can send to the winner of the guessing competition. Jones had appropriated John Stuart Mill to his own purposes, had the audacity to chide others for their lack of familiarity with Mill, and refused to back that back down. Jones is not alone in his failure to read those he quotes. The practice was so common in Mill's own time that it's referred to in Trollope's novel, He Knew He Was Right, and I'll show you the next slide here. Your John Stuart Mill is a great man, said the minister, Mr. Spalding. They tell me so, said Mr. Grascock. I don't read what he writes myself. This acknowledgement seemed to the minister to be almost disgraceful. I mean, he himself had never read a word of Mr. Mill's writings. He's a far-seeing minister. Continued the minister, he's one of the few Europeans who can look forward and see how the rivers of civilization are running on. He's understood that women must at last be put upon an equality with men. He got at least that last part of the argument right, which is rather more, I think, than can be said for many modern interpreters of Mill. John Stuart Mill makes his most regular appearances today in discussions of freedom of speech. He pops up almost as regularly as Voltaire. And he haunts discussions and arguments about freedom of action more generally in contemporary times as well. In terms of our understanding of the value of freedom today, the main legacy of On Liberty, which I want to begin with, is taken to be what we now know as the harm principle. The harm principle is the principle that actions should not be subject to regulation unless they cause harm, or more exactly, harm to others. Mill is the godfather of this phrase, I should be free to do as I like as long as I don't harm anyone else. Not everyone who cites the harm principle is aware, though, that its provenance is in fact Mill's On Liberty. Not everybody is aware that they're an heir to Mill. A student once pointed me to this song, which I'll get up, come here, called Burn One Down. This is by a singer of the profound called Ben Harper. I believe it's an ode to smoking dope, as you can see there. My choice is what I choose to do, and if I'm causing harm, it shouldn't bother you. Your choice is who you choose to be, and if you're causing no harm, then you're all right with me. If you don't like my, and it's pronounced fire, this tendency that people have to give more syllables to words these days, if you don't like my fire, then don't come around. When pop singers like this get philosophical, I always think about Nigel Tufnell's explanation of his song "Lick My Love Pump" in "This Is Spinal Tap." They seem almost as ridiculous in that. I'm not sure that Ben Harper or those who enthusiastically sing along to these profound ditties of his know of Mill. Often students of mine who do sing along to Ben Harper disdain any connection to a reviled liberal like Mill. This idea that they could have any connection at all to a liberal is somehow quite disgusting to them. Mill certainly called himself a liberal, but a complicating factor here was that he also professed, at the same time, a passionate adherence to some form of socialism. He apparently saw no conflict at all between his description of himself as a liberal and his loyalty to French socialists such as Saint-Simon and even the presently delirious Fourier. In the last chapter of his autobiography, in fact, Mill claimed that his ideal went, as he said, far beyond democracy, and he said, "I would class myself as a socialist." In considering Mill's legacy, what he is for us, I think that it's very important, just as I begin, to remember that Mill was not a defender of the rich or of the powerful. It gives some sense of the tone of his political outlook. Here's a passage from Mill's letter to his friend John Sperling, written just after the 1830 revolution in France. I'll read it. "If there were but a few dozens of persons safe," he said to Sperling, "to be missionaries of the great truths, in which alone there's any well-being for mankind, I should not care, though a revolution were to exterminate every person in Great Britain and Ireland who has £500 a year." Mill finished, "Many very amiable persons would perish, but what is the world the better for such amiable persons?" You know, I think this is the source of Philip Toynbee's quip about the bomb under the West car park at Twickenham, setting back fascism in England for a generation. Or again, another slide here, you can see as revolution again simmered in France in 1847, Mill wrote to his friend John Austin and said, "In England, in contrast to France, I often think that a violent revolution is very much needed." I must say at this point, this language is something that I have a great deal of trouble with, particularly the term exterminate, but perhaps it meant a little bit different. I doubt, but I'm giving the benefit of the doubt. Mill said, "A violent revolution is very much needed in order to give that general shake-up to the torpid mind of the nation which the French Revolution gave to continental Europe. England has never had any general break-up of old associations, and hence the extreme difficulty of getting any ideas put stupid in." So in thinking about Mill today, I think it's very important to recall how Mill considered himself, that he considered himself and was considered to be by his friends and by others to be on the very radical side of politics. The picture of Mill that you can see here, which is the iconic picture of Mill, not his wife, but his daughter-in-law, sorry, stepdaughter, maybe, Helen Taylor, this picture of Mill as a staid Victorian just doesn't ring true. In the rest of the talk, I want to give an example of how putting Mill in the right perspective might actually help us to not only read Mill correctly and not misquote him, but how putting Mill in the right perspective might help us to think through some of our own dilemmas about freedom. So my point is not simply that we should read people and read them carefully, the people who formed our views, but that if we do read them carefully, we might actually learn something new and of interest to us. So the central principle for Mill is that of freedom, and the value of freedom for him is a priori. It's an a priori, it's a given, and he argues that any regulation of human conduct needs to be rigorously argued for and justified. As I said before, the most well-known caveat to this permission for freedom is actions that do harm to others. Mill, in his works, didn't tell us in any great detail what he meant by harm. It's actually quite a difficult notion, and, for example, the American philosopher Joel Feinberg has taken up the stack here by writing four volumes, very thick volumes, on the topic. For Mill, harm is not simply pain. It's not necessarily pain. And perhaps the best sense of what he means by harm is where he talks about affecting prejudicially the interests of others. So the principle here, the issue, is that the threshold for restrictions on freedom comes when our actions affect prejudicially the interests of others, and at that threshold, society gains some kind of coercive jurisdiction over the conduct of its members. At the outset of On Liberty, Mill sets this out very clearly and tells us what he's doing in the book. It's a rather long passage, but I'll just I'll skip through it for you and give you the main parts. The object of this essay, he says, is to assert one very simple principle as entitled to govern absolutely the dealings of society with the individual. That principle, he says, is that the sole end for which mankind is warranted in interfering with the liberty of action of any of their number is self-protection. The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilised community against his will is to prevent harm to others. The only part of the conduct of anyone, Mill concludes here, for which he is amenable to society is that which concerns others. In the part which merely concerns himself, his independence is of right absolute. Over himself, over his own body and mind, the individual is sovereign. If you've read John Stuart Mill at university, that passage at least would be very familiar to you. What's interesting about this passage, I think, is that for Mill, the central value here is not the harm principle, but the sovereignty of the individual. That the thing that's at issue or the focus is the sovereignty of the individual, and to make the value of freedom an a priori is a way of respecting that sovereignty. Mill clarifies that question a little later in On Liberty, where he explains the simple principle a little bit more, and I've put it in yellow there. The reason for not interfering, unless for the sake of others, Mill says, is consideration for his liberty. A person's voluntary choice is evidence that what he chooses is desirable, or at least endurable to him, and his good is on the whole best provided for by allowing him to take his own means of pursuing it. But that passage where Mill explains the question of freedom comes in the middle of a discussion of slavery, and it's this that I want to focus on. It's precisely for Mill, on the basis of consideration for the liberty of others, that Mill says you cannot voluntarily become somebody else's slave. You cannot voluntarily sell yourself to another person. Because by doing that, you would defeat, he says, the very purpose of freedom. So if you place that passage in the fuller context of Chapter 5, which I'm not sure that all students get to Chapter 5 more on liberty, Mill says that if you sell yourself for a slave, you abdicate your liberty, you have foregone any further use of it, and you therefore defeat the very purpose, which is the justification of allowing you to dispose of yourself. And Mill ends, the principle of freedom cannot require that he should be free not to be free. It's not freedom to be allowed to alienate his freedom. So this has the conclusion for Mill that in this and most other civilised countries, even a seemingly voluntary agreement to sell yourself as a slave would be void, not able to be enforced by law or opinion. Now, one of the implications of this for Mill is that it would be very wrong to mistake a person's acquiescence in a dependent situation as a free choice. What he's saying here, I think, is that if you want to respect the sovereignty of people, that requires that you regard the question of their civil status or their standing as closed and non-negotiable, even if the person themselves thinks otherwise and wants to be a slave, wants to abdicate their standing as a free person. Now, that's a very strange formulation, I think, that somebody wants to be a slave. Well, if we think about slavery in terms of Cleopatra rowing the slaves up, you know, being rowed up the Nile, few people would think that somebody would want to be a slave. But Mill was not talking about slaves rowing Cleopatra up the Nile. He was talking about cases like that of Andrew McLean. Andrew McLean was acquitted for the attempted murder of his de facto wife, Mary Ann Watson, in 1851. The evidence in this case was as follows, and I'll place it. Early in the morning of August, the persons lodging in the next room were disturbed by the cries of Andrew McLean's children, one called Lizzie, aged 8, and the younger child was aged 3. The children called out, "Father, let Mother down." The neighbours got up in consequence, went into the room where they found his wife hanging by the neck from the cupboard, and the prisoner was, as he then became, was sitting upon the bed. The body of the unfortunate woman was quite suspended. She was nearly black in the face. When the prisoner, Andrew McLean, was told that he was a good-for-nothing villain for attempting to hang his wife, he replied that he'd do it better next time, effectually next time. One of the witnesses answered that he would have done it that time if his wife had not been cut down. The prisoner, in his defence, Andrew McLean, asserted that his wife had hanged herself. His wife, Mary Ann Watson, or his de facto wife, was not called as a witness at the trial of McLean. She'd previously been examined by the magistrate And she claimed to the magistrate that she had spoken provokingly to her husband, McCain, and also that he'd hanged her only in jest. Now, for Mill, this was a classic case of slavery. Mill understood this as a case of sexual slavery. And when he talks about slavery in such passages as this, these are the types of situations that he's talking about. He understood sexual slavery as the most powerful obstacle to widening the scope of freedom in society. He argued in very radical terms again that marriage is a form, in his time, marriage was a form of unjust power and of slavery. Marriage, he said, is the only actual bondage known to our law. There remain no legal slaves except the mistress of their every house. Mill conceded that women like Mary Ann Watson, who'd been hanged, he conceded that many women, most women in his time, acquiesced in the system, and he noted that women are not collectively rebellious to the power of men. But for Mill, this acquiescence or quietism, whatever you want to call it, is not evidence or illustration of their freely adopted choices. You can't take that as an expression of choice or of their freedom. Mill explained that in his time, the women, in fact, who were slaves in marriage, were in a far worse position than actual slaves because they had given their sentiments to their husband. Mill talks about how this has come about, that men in his time, husbands in his time, relied not merely on brute force, but on an education in sentiments to have women take the position that they... In the circumstances that he's talking about then, what he wants to say is that what looks like consent or agreement, and again, I can't help thinking of the footballer's questions about consent. In these circumstances, consent to these conditions can't count as the act of a sovereign or independent individual. For me, when people consent in those circumstances, it's simply a measure to salvage some dignity from an intolerable situation. So he says, for example, to those to whom nothing but servitude is allowed, the free choice of servitude is the only, although almost insufficient, alleviation. To refuse to consent in those cases would complete the assimilation of the wife to a brutish slave. Mill also, in this context, noted the persistence of the marital rape exemption, which, as you know, in England was only abolished in the UK. All these passages and others on slavery are only very rarely alluded to in modern discussions of freedom and Mill. They're even more rarely mentioned in discussions of freedom of speech or discussion. Most popular, as well as academic users of Mill, are content with the familiar ringing passages that we all know on freedom from on liberty and to lift them completely out of this context. But the importance of this context in understanding what Mill says about freedom can also be seen in the extraordinary series of articles on cruelty and personal violence that Mill wrote, in most cases with his wife Harriet Taylor. These articles concern such topics as military justice, the abuse of children, the vicious ill-treatment of servants. Most are concerned with or make mention of husbands' brutality to their wives. And in those cases, an issue that brutality was almost invariably brought to the attention of police, not by the targeted women, but by neighbours or bystanders. One of the most startling of Mill's newspaper commentaries here concerns the case of William Byrne, who was brought up on a charge of cruelly beating his horse. The magistrate in this case released Byrne with a small fine on learning that he had a wife and a family to support. Mill, in quite what I find an extraordinary statement, infers that simply because Byrne beat his horse, he also beat his wife and family, that is, his slaves, as he called them. Mill said, disgusting enough it is that animals like these, he means Byrne, not the horse, Byrne should have wives and children. And disgusting, he says, merely because they are the same, because they are the male sex, they should have the whole existence of these dependents as much under their absolute control as slave masters. But as if this were all not enough, Mill goes on, a man is told by the magistrate that because he has a family to ill use, he may indulge himself in ill using any other creatures who come in his way, and may practice on them the amiable propensities of which his family are to reap the full enjoyment. Mill argued that in this case, if you really wanted to respect the wife and the children, that the magistrate would have spoken a very different language, and that language would have elicited a very different punishment on Byrne from the small fine that he paid. So these articles that Neil Wright really give sort of substance to his discussion of slavery in On Liberty in particular. One final example is in a pamphlet on the Fitzroy Bill of 1853, which was concerned with domestic violence. Neil and his wife, by then his wife, argued that a culture of impunity applied to what they called domestic atrocity, what we call domestic violence. And he argued that punishments for personal violence were gravely insufficient. I should note here that those terms that Neil uses in this context, like atrocity and ruffians, don't have the same force for us as they did for Neil. You know, we're used to characterising the children's spelling mistakes as atrocious, whereas for Neil, atrocity refers to a horrible or a heinous wickedness, in the sense of the atrocity of Christ's passion, for example. Or, you know, I often refer to my son's friends as a bunch of ruffians, but I mean that they're scallywags, not that they're low and brutal characters or cutthroat villains or swaggering bullies in the sense that Mill used the word. Now, the argument, what follows on from Mill's arguments here, is that flogging is the appropriate punishment for crimes of brutality involved in domestic atrocity. Mill said that for these crimes, nothing will be effectual but to retaliate upon the culprit some portion of the physical suffering which he's inflicted. And he argued that this flogging should be relentless and in public. Mill said, it's probably the only punishment which these people would feel, those who presume on their consciousness of animal strength to brutally ill-treat those who are physically weaker would thereby be made to know what it is to be in the hands of a physical strength. Flogging, Mill said, is the moral medicine needed for the domineering arrogance of brute power. I don't know about you, but they never told me about this aspect of Mill when I did, when I was an undergraduate. Mill and Taylor argued that instituting flogging, public flogging, for a domestic atrocity would do more for the improvement of morality and the relief of suffering than any act of Parliament passed in this country, not excepting perhaps the Act for the Abolition of Slavery. In these and similar passages, Mill takes the view that the law, and particularly the criminal law, is an instrument of moral education and that which exercises the most powerful influence on the character of citizens. What is even more striking, I think, is that Mill thought that this use of the criminal law is not open to discussion. He said, we can argue about many different things. Churches and political parties may quarrel about the teaching of doctrines, but not about the punishment of such crimes. There's diversity of opinion, he says, about what is morally good, but there ought to be none about what is atrociously wicked. So Mill's picture of the law as moral teacher, whip in hand here, includes the makers and the administrators of the law, citizens, legislators, judges and juries. This openly interventionist and coercive role of the law that's commended by Mill is quite at odds, I think, with the general picture painted of his work by most modern interpreters. Most modern writers on Mill like what they see in Mill, and what they see is Mill calling for a retreat of the state from regulating the realm of citizens. Mill's vision of the criminal law in regard to acts of personal violence was what would be, on most people's understanding, draconian. According to Mill, the lenient punishment that was at present in his present time meted out for brutality to the slaves called wives is in contrast to the severity of punishment for property offences. In one of these articles on cruelty written in the 1850s, Mill told the story of Alexander Smith, who'd been flogged for pawning a gold watch. Mill characterises this apparent disparity in punishment between offences of property and offences of personal violence as itself a crime of legislatures and courts. And he sums up that courts and legislators have yet to learn that there is a thing infinitely more important than property, and that thing is the freedom and the sacredness of human personality. He said there is an immeasurable distance in point of moral enormity between any of the gravest offences that concerns only property and an act of insulting and degrading violence perpetrated against a human being. And he concluded this little passage by saying, mankind could go on very well and have gone on in time past and will go on with property being very insecure. But Mill says, but subject to blows or the fear of blows, mankind could be no other than soulless, terror-stricken slaves without virtue, without courage, without peace, with nothing to call their own. So So, just to sum up here, what is at stake for Mill in human affairs, in this understanding, is the freedom and sacredness of human personality. And for him, government has a legitimate and a quite extensive role in the protection of human personality through the criminal law. Mill argues that the ordinary protection of law is protection only for those who can help themselves, who can keep themselves out of harm's way or can tell their own story, not for people like Marianne Watson. I'll finish with one last story and sum up. The story concerns an incident late one night on a London street. It concerned a man called Patrick McGovern, who knocked down a woman. This assault was witnessed by William Smith, a policeman, who didn't put that one up, but that's a feature of Mill's logic and his being friendly with women. This assault by Patrick McGovern was witnessed by William Smith, who struck the assailant with his policeman's truncheon in an attempt to protect her. For that action, Constable Smith was brought before the magistrate, Benson, Ralph Augustus Benson, who sentenced him to a month in prison with hard labour for what he called an unprovoked, brutal and unjustifiable assault. Smith was dismissed from the police force and he was not reinstated despite protests made on his behalf. This story involves a fairly standard incident of what we call domestic violence, what Mill calls domestic atrocity. What makes it atypical was the action of Constable Smith in coming to the aid of the woman who'd been knocked down, Eliza McGovern. What also makes it atypical then as now is that it came to public attention, and was the subject of a newspaper report. Mill noted that for every such case that you find in the newspapers, there are hundreds or even thousands going on in the safety of complete obscurity. This newspaper report on William Smith, the policeman, came to the attention of Mill, who was one of those who petitioned the Attorney General, Sir Robert Collier, to have Constable Smith reinstated in the police force. Mill wrote to Collier, "I am not a partisan of the police. On the contrary, I greatly distrust them, and I think that magistrates rely too much on their evidence and often treat instances of bribery, perjury, and other highly criminal conduct on their part with most undue lenity." But Mill thought that in this case, the policeman had acted correctly, and he was very concerned with how the verdict in the case would influence men's judgment on what it was wise and just and prudent to do in regard to women. That this was not a good lesson for the law to teach. I want to finish with this incident as a way of refocusing and having another look at on liberty, refocusing our understanding and interpretation of on liberty. As I said in the beginning, on liberty is usually interpreted as a statement of negative liberty. We're familiar with the term that people can choose to be the person they want to be if they're free from the intervention of government or society. Mill was certainly suspicious of the state, and as he says quite clearly, he was no partisan of the police. But he did countenance and approve a far-reaching and coercive role for the state in enhancing the equal standing of men and women. What I'd like to suggest in closing is that the argument on liberty is best understood as founded on a primary concern with the status of persons and the sacredness of the human personality, rather than with simply setting the limits of government in terms of the harm principle of harm to others. So what I'm suggesting here is that the arguments about freedom and non-liberty should best be understood as founded on really the sovereignty principle rather than the harm principle. And that just as Mill's work on non-liberty is best understood in those terms, many of our predicaments today would also be better understood in terms of defending the sacredness of the human personality rather than simply guarding against harm to others.
Don't go too far away. Many thanks for that. I guess we're all here, as we come to question discussion, we'll finish no later than 7, but I guess we're all here tonight because we're interested in John Stuart Mill. But for some people, say, who might be listening on our podcast in the future, just before we come to question discussion, just fill us in a bit on who was Stuart Mill, John Stuart Mill. I mean, also you mentioned the fact that he wrote some of his work with his wife, which I guess at that stage it was unusual, certainly to do it, but probably very unusual to acknowledge it. So just give us a bit of a biographical sketch and we'll move on to discussion. Yeah.
I love nothing better than the gossip. In Mill's case, there's a lot of gossip and a very interesting story. Mill wrote a very what I find an enthralling autobiography, which includes his early childhood and his somewhat bizarre, I think you'd have to say, childhood, where he learned Latin and Greek at a very early age. And he was under the tutelage of Jeremy Bentham and his father. His father, James Mill, was a political economist, a very famous political economist in his own right. Mill became a utilitarian in the sense that James Mill, his father, and Bentham understood the term and joined the East India Company as an article. Even though that might sound quite staid and conventional, Mill was apparently given to the latest biographer, Richard Reeves, tells us that Mill used to strip off when he wanted to think. So he'd be in his desk at the East India Company and apparently would run up and down and took his coat off, and apparently even in some circumstances, as a friend of mine says, doesn't bear thinking about. But sort of quite an unconventional person, led a fairly conventional life until in his 20s he had changed his entire life, I think, and it certainly led him off into directions that he hadn't gone in, particularly, I think, cultivating in him a love of poetry and the arts, which he hadn't had before, and led him to meet the Taylor, who was at that stage married to John Taylor. They had married to John Taylor for another 20 years or so. There are many different kind of opinions, I think, about Harriet Taylor and her influence on Mill. This last 2 years have seen the bicentennial of Mill's birth and the bicentennial of Harriet Taylor's birth. We've been to conferences, big conferences on the bicentennial in London, where we had a spirited discussion about what sort of a woman was Harriet. But certainly a lot of people thought that she ruined Mill's mind, and others, Mill himself, thought that. Credits her with co-writing most of their work, although most work has only Mill's name on it, but they pen this series of newspaper articles that I mentioned in the paper together. I'm always open to telling you any more gossip that I can. I know a lot.
No, it's fine. I mean, I think particularly since you started off with something about rugby league and you learned that he took his clothes off as probably for a process of male bonding or something. It's all very...
I don't think we went that far.
I mean, when we actually talked on John Stuart Mill for today, we didn't mean so today, we sort of meant yesterday. Okay, so see, any questions, discussion? Yeah.
All right. Many civil libertarians quote him and are very much in favour of not incarcerating mentally ill when they are sick. The result of this often is that people commit suicide or are pat raped, which is a very common experience for a mentally ill girl, be pat raped, and they are never taken to court. Their evidence wouldn't be, they can't sustain the evidence. What would be Mill's view on the mentally ill and treatment of the mentally ill?
Can you hear after that? Okay, can you repeat that?
The question is, what many civil libertarians use Mill's work in connection with, use Mill's work in connection with talking about the mentally ill and the incarceration of the mentally ill. And in the incarceration of the mentally, particularly young women who are mentally ill, many harms befall them when they're incarcerated.
They use Mill's work to argue against the incarceration of mentally ill.
Just that
when people are not incarcerated, they're raped.
I misunderstood you. Yes.
In other words, a question about Mill having a bad influence, right?
Well, I'm not blaming you, it's my
people are using having a bad influence.
I guess I say here that I don't... the paper is really meant to show that Mill isn't a libertarian in that sense. I think his position is far more complex. Though I would say one thing here, which is that sometimes people ask this question, what would Mill say about this? Or what would Mill say about that? And you often find that Mill has said something about this. So I'll have a look in his collected works, which are now on the internet, and I can sort of do a search on them. But Mill wrote on many things that we're actually concerned with, and people act as if
they
act as if he actually
didn't write on
such prostitution.
Oh,
we go to Duncan, then we go to
Lindsay, just following on from that last question, thinking about the principle of harm, how would Mill have dealt with self-harm, and particularly with suicide or attempted suicide?
Well,
which was a crime, of course, at the time that he was writing.
The question of how Mill would have dealt with self-harm, or in particular suicide.
I think he would have... The thing with harm, I think, is that Mill would have looked at the circumstances in which people made their choices. So often when we talk about how would we deal with, as you know, liberals today, how would we deal with this question, and we simply look at how people... What are people's expressed choices? Rather than looking, as Mill, I think, would, to look at the circumstances, the context, the background against which they make their choices. So rather than just saying, you know, self-harm, I think Mill would, I hope I'm right here, I think he'd sort of say, well, it depends. And not to get out of the question, but it depends on the circumstances. So, for example, somebody in full possession of their faculties, with purity, somebody, I think it would depend in that way. But again, it's sort of really important not simply to look at people's, what they express their choices to be, but how they have come to form. Often we think of that question, how did somebody come to form their choice? We think of that as a rather paternalistic question, and how on earth did they come to form that choice? But Mill thought that it was a legitimate question to ask. How did they come? Think of that choice as a... as the expression of the
dream. Prepared to hypothesise what Mill would have thought about the arguments concerning a Bill of Rights in the 20th and 21st century, and if you're not, did he express a view on the rights movements and those in, at the time in America and France?
Question about John Stuart Mill on the concept of a Bill of Rights possibly, or his attitude to the rights movements that existed in Britain and France at the time.
In US and France
at the time.
Mill had been educated by Jeremy Bentham, and I don't know if you know Bentham's famous sort of bon mot on rights, which was that rights are natural rights are nonsense upon stilts. And he said rights are nonsense and natural rights are nonsense upon stilts, elevated nonsense, and. Which, and I actually have some sympathy with this view. I have a lot of sympathy with this view, which is that rights aren't necessarily best protected by a Bill of Rights, and they're not necessarily best protected by statements of rights. They can be best protected, sort of, for example, by democratic deliberation. And I think Mill's view was that Mill's, like Bentham's, remained in this way, that rights weren't necessarily the best way to talk about democratic deliberation or equality or justice in a society. So just, even though I'm prepared to do a bit more than hypothesise here, I think, because they talked about this question quite a lot. And the language that they used was certainly not one of rights. They didn't think that was they nevertheless were important.
In the beginning about your students not being happy about it, aspect of me that is the liberal aspect of me. Could you elaborate on that and what do students look for in Mill?
Question about students not being happy with the so-called liberal aspect of Mill.
My university, I'm struck all the time by people who, by students and it has specific faculty who think of liberal as kind of a pejorative term. I'm not always sure exactly what they mean by it, but you know they'll say, put the hand on the hip, and you know I am not a liberal. What do you mean by that? And when you ask what do you mean by that, they sort of look at you as if you're a bit silly. You know, and maybe you don't know these things. And sort of, well, if you don't know, I'm not going to tell you. I think what they mean is that they think of liberal writers as not radical.
The extreme right and the extreme left both had a lot of disdain for.
And so, Mill has this reputation of being a liberal. He called himself that, and so we know him that. So he sort of falls into the pot with all the other baddies there as well. I think but it's really such a travesty of who he was and of what his work was about.
Going back to domestic violence and 19th century position of women in the 19th century, feminists at that time were very inclined to be sort of in the temperance movement and looking to restricting violent men's access to alcohol. Mm. Now, did Mill have a view on this? Because it seems to me that that would be a real problem for him, because they were onto something that might work, but on the other hand, you need state intervention to do that.
He was on good terms with women in the temperance movement and doesn't seem to have any great trouble with that. My sense is that he understood alcohol as quite destructive and as associated with domestic violence and other forms of brutality. And so one of the examples that he gives in the last chapter of On Liberty concerns drunkenness and whether drunkenness is something to be regulated. So again, you don't need to hypothesise, he actually talks about it. And he talks about it in, he says, well, you know, you must again draw a distinction between the context or the circumstances in which somebody is drunk. So, for example, somebody who drinks in their own little attic and drinks himself, you know, silly. A different case from somebody where alcohol affects their duty, such as a policeman. But that, to me, is a wider statement about if alcohol affects your moral duties, then I think it's something... I don't think he was terribly sympathetic towards... I think he was very sympathetic towards temperance movements. That's something I share, though, so... I don't find
the
trouble with it, but I know
other people do. To some extent, though, to go on with that, temperance movements have been misunderstood in the same way as John Stuart Mill's misunderstood. Mm. So to what extent are his views able to be interpreted outside of their context? It seems to me that that's the problem with a lot of those who make political philosophy or humanist kind of endeavours their field. It seems that later on, because of our circumstances, if you just take the words or the statements, they don't mean anything unless you understand the context. And to what extent is this a problem?
I think that's very much a problem, but in Mill it's sort of so far-reaching because it affects the whole kind of understanding of what freedom is about and of what it's valuable for and how it should be nurtured and governed and regulated by the state or by government. So I think it's such a mess. It's not just... I mentioned Voltaire at the beginning. I wrote a little article about Voltaire's statement, you know, that I disagree with what you say, but I'll fight to the death for what...
You're right to say that.
You're right to say it. Of course, Voltaire never said anything like... anything remotely like that. And it's all kind of... but it's become something that's really... taking on a life of its own, get everybody from the Prime Minister. But I think with Mill it's more than just, you know, the misuse of one little statement here. It's a word which makes him less interesting than he was, and makes him less interesting in turn, makes him less interesting to us than he was.
As you know, there was a lot of discussion in the 18th century and in the 19th century about revolution. You quote there Mill advocating violent revolution in certain circumstances, yet on the other hand, as you demonstrated, he was profoundly opposed to violence against people. How did he equate those two positions?
He actually deals with, again, I'm not hypothesising, he actually deals with this question of, he said, for the most part, brutality and corporal punishment are to be abhorred. But in certain circumstances, these things are both necessary and just. I think to some extent it's his approval of the revolution is a different question from the question of corporal punishment, flogging. So I sort of try and keep those two questions apart a little bit. With the flogging, it's quite clear that what he sees is something that is an example, and that given they have exercised brutality on others, then there's really no problem for him at all to exercise brutality back on them. What is a problem, I think, is his approval of violent revolution and extermination, or his seeming approval of that. That I find, I suppose because it's not something that I have a great deal of sympathy for, I find it a little bit more difficult. Yeah.
Well, the context of where people are not so pluralistic, and where the only way up is to overthrow, So we live in a pluralistic society, but if you lived in a stratified society, one where people were, very severely kept in their place, then the word revolution has a different meaning. Whereas to us, it just means blood and death. I mean, that statement about the English, I find extraordinary too. But he's obviously being very expansive.
But there's statements like that all through. If you read On Liberty again, there's statements like that are littered right throughout the work as well. Statements about the deadness of the English and what it means to shake the English up and so forth. So it's sometimes I think we sort of it's not dumbing down, but it's calming down. Sort of what's going on here, and then it's actually it's very stirring work.
Duncan. Yeah.
Coming back to the issue of punishment again and the moral educated function of criminal law, we already talked about and apparently fairly justified in allowing certain types of flogging. But he wrote about the time that transportation was coming to an end in Australia. I just wondered whether his work had any impact on the debate about transportation and its brutality.
But at one of the conferences that I went to as part of Mill's Bicentennial, there was somebody who was doing a lot of work about Mill and his friend's influence on the layout of Adelaide. But that's about the only Australian. And Harriet's brothers, I think, went to Adelaide, lived there, and died there. Their families, I think, they might be still descendants of Harriet Taylor there, but that's about the only Australian connection I can do. Sorry, I can't do the transportation connection version of that one.
To me, it seems that often we have fear and panic in our society, which leads to a utilitarian approach. Issues such as terrorism legislation, driven by fear and panic, with it under cloak of a utilitarian approach. Is this something that Mill would have accepted as being necessary? Or
I think he was sort of rather sceptical of that. You mentioned the question of utilitarianism. I think that's Mill called himself a utilitarian, but there's really a sense in which I think he was a very strange utilitarian. Utilitarians don't usually have a sense of something beyond the greatest happiness of the greatest number, and Mill certainly thought that the greatest happiness of the greatest number was not really the way in which you would judge the justice of a society or a government. And he really diverged away from his father's, from his early education on that. So it's a kind of question, but probably not as much connection to my paper here about Mill's, whether Mill was utilitarian or not. And also, he wrote even in the work that he wrote called On Utilitarianism, it seems that he talks about, for example, intrinsic pleasures, that things are intrinsically more valuable, certain things are intrinsically more valuable than others. And Bentham, who was a classic utilitarian, said, "No, everything's equal. Pushpin is as good as poetry. Tennis and bowling, whatever, is as good as poetry." Mill didn't think that. Mill thought that poetry was intrinsically better than pushpin.
Richard.
Have a sense of going too far. Because I think when you think of freedom of expression, and in this case, the example of the way in which pornography has come in to affect society in the way in which it can impact. A lot of us would agree that there are many lines that need to be drawn on the idea of what should be quite liberal and free to express. Do you have this sense of line that needs to be drawn?
I can tell you, he never talked about pornography. That he never talked about. I think he did understand that this is sort of something that I'm working on, if I could just interject, and I don't know how true it is to Mill, but my sense is that Mill's understanding of freedom of speech is really that speech doesn't add anything. He talks about freedom of action, and freedom of action should be allowed as long as it doesn't harm others. Why can't we apply that same test to speech? And I think Mill actually did believe that. He didn't believe that a special argument about speech was needed on top of action. I think Mill sort of thinks that they fall under the same category. So the question then is not, is speech different from action? Because I don't think it is in most cases. It doesn't raise special cases. But the question is, does it harm others? And harm is not, harm, as I began, is not merely causing pain to somebody. You know, we all know that pain is a harm, but we all know that harms go well, even physical harms, go well beyond pain and are not solely defined by pain. But, you know, the question is, what is harm? And harm is a discrimination, for example. So that would be one way. Harm is also, harm also includes incitement to harm. So Mill has this famous example about somebody inciting the mob to violence, for example. It's not that it's gone too far, but I think his position on freedom of speech was much more complex than it's often put. Let a rip, you know, is not Mill's position.
There's a succession of British philosophers and authors over those few hundred years that we still today, and this year we're celebrating Charles Darwin, his writings. Mm. And when Darwin wrote, he took on the church in a big way. I wonder whether when Mill wrote, there was anyone pro-statist or whatever who saw his views as potentially subversive and came out in opposition, the same way Darwin was challenged at the time.
I think that many people did, and one of the most famous was one of the Stephens who was very opposed to Mill's whole way of understanding equality in society. I think the big threat that people saw Mill's work as posing at that time was the threat of equality more than anything else. So it wasn't
equality among the sexual equality,
but also to some extent among classes, but particularly sexual equality.
And
that was
the question.
Thank you. John Stuart Mill for today. In today's society, what do you think would be his ban? Would he be trying to fix or trying to change?
I think perhaps, I'd have to say this, I think perhaps prostitution and trafficking, because that was a very big concern of his at the time, and one on which he took in quite an extraordinary position, which again wouldn't in any circumstances fall in the category of libertarian. Mill thought that men visiting brothels should be subject to surveillance. That doesn't fall into the category of libertarianism, any category. And he was very concerned about that question. Questions about, again, I think about real equality, I think that equality would be the answer in a broad sense.
Helena, we may leave it there. Thanks very much. I think that's a good point to end up on, because the whole issue of human trafficking for prostitution, as you know, is an immense problem throughout most of the world. And, so it's interesting to reflect what Mill actually wrote about that well over a century. Helen, as I said earlier on, sent me a note saying that this was the 150th anniversary of On Liberty. But I thought it was, it reminded me that Mill was an important thinker and this was an important occasion, and I'm glad we had you talk tonight. It'll be a good paper when Anne puts out the Sydney papers, and it'll be a good talk off on our podcast, because he was a very significant thinker, and as you're well aware, often people who have an influence beyond people who've read them, and that's certainly the case with Mill. He has an drive and some of them don't, but he has that influence. So many thanks for coming along tonight and giving us an encompassing view of John Stuart Mill on this historical occasion, and all the best for the future. Thank you.
Thank you.